Kitchen Garden on Community Radio Kilkenny City 88.7 FM with Frances Nesbitt and Mags Morrissey.
Hello and you're very welcome to the Kitchen Garden on Community Radio Kilkenny City. I am Frances Nesbitt from Crowine Cottages here in Kilkenny and I'm joined as usual by Mags Morrissey from the Hedgehog Bakery in Thomastown. You can get in touch with the show today with any questions or comments that you might have. You can call the station on 7762 777, or you can text 086 353 7782, or at any stage during the week you can email kitchengarden@crkc.ie. And we're live today, Friday from 4 to 5, and the show is repeated on Mondays from 4 to 5. Now today on the show we'll be talking about food on the edge. We'll be talking about some of the events coming up in Savor over the weekend. We'll be talking about some other Halloween themed events that are coming up around the county. And in the garden we'll be joined again by Dermot Carey to talk a little about onions and garlic and how to plant those now in order to reap a harvest in the springtime. Mags, how are you?
I'm very good.
A busy food week?
Well, one of the highlights of my week actually was not food, but the natural environment. I was coming home very late on Sunday night, actually, and I spotted two badgers fighting in the middle of the road.
My God.
First of all, I've never seen two together.
Yeah.
I've never seen two fighting, and I've never seen them in the middle of a road. So it was very exciting. And they stayed for a while. They weren't huge, so I don't know whether they were kind of the males, I'm guessing, obviously, because they were fighting. But the shorter days can stimulate kind of a second peak of mating activity at the moment, so that might have been what they were up to. And also this time of the year, they're kind of feeding heavily to lay down reserves for the winter. But it was quite... because when I could see it as I was driving along, I didn't know what it was for a few seconds. But yeah, that was exciting. Other than that, I know you mentioned food education, and I sent the woofer, Michelle the woofer, mm-hmm. whose mother is listening in Germany, out to get some beetroot. And I just said, can you pick six beetroot? And she kind of looked at me and then she said, where are they? I'm thinking, have you not noticed them? You know, but I just said they're at the back of the garden, gave her the directions kind of. And then today, when we were pickling them, she said that she had never actually seen beetroot before. Ah. So that's why she didn't know what they were. But now she not only knows what they look like in the ground, but she actually made beetroot pickle. So that's my contribution to food education this
well done.
Week.
Yeah. Well done. So beetroot isn't stuff that comes sliced in a jar. She went looking
no,
for the jars.
No, maybe they just
don't
have it in Germany, in fairness to her. But yeah. Yeah, she didn't. She'd never seen it and she'd never actually eaten it. So
brilliant.
Yeah.
That's great. Well, on the food education thing, I was at, as you know, Food on the Edge in Galway Monday and Tuesday of this week. And Food on the Edge is an annual symposium now. It's in its fourth, fifth year in Galway. JP McMahon, the founder, is the owner of a Michelin star chef restaurant in Galway, and he has two other restaurants there too. And he brings together about 50 chefs from around the world, chefs and food professionals, I would say, from around the world. And they talk to each other and to an audience and generate general discussion around food, where it comes from, how we're using it, the future of food, trends, and so on. The lads from Highbank Orchard were down there 2 years ago, I remember, talking about soil and growing of food. And one of the main themes of the symposium this year was around education for young people. Now, I recorded some great interviews over there that we can use on future shows. I met some fantastic people. I spoke to JP himself, Diana Henry, who won our Cookbook of the Year last year for her book Simple. She was there speaking about British food. A brilliant British chef called Paul Cunningham, and he has a two Michelin starred restaurant up in Denmark. And if you have two stars in Denmark, you have to be doing something right.
Yes.
Another Michelin star chef, Nathan Outlaw from Cornwall. He has a very, very famous fish restaurant down there. And he's kicked off a new, or he's become the patron of a charity in the UK that's kind of supporting lobsters and raising awareness of them and their life cycle and the age that
I've
they have to.
I've heard this guy, actually.
A fantastic character. Yeah. Really, really fantastic character. And they have a hatchery down there now where they're releasing baby lobsters into the sea. And then I spoke to another guy called Joe Warwick. Remember, you know the top 50 restaurants list that's kind of published every year. Yes. NOMA was at the top of it for 2 or 3 years. Well, he was the founder or the creator of that. It's become a bit of a monster. It seems to have kind of gotten away from him at this point now. So he's moved on and he's creating a new awards, international, global restaurant awards system. And he spoke to me about that. Fantastic character, real live wire. And then a woman that you would have loved to speak to, and her message is so important. A chef called Joshna Maharaj.
I had dinner with her on Sunday night.
Go on.
Yes.
That's hilarious.
Yes. She loved my bread.
And that was the night before Food on the Edge. You had dinner with her.
Yeah.
That is hilarious.
I had to forego my ticket to go on Monday, actually. But anyway, she's quite a character.
And all about like nutrition in hospitals and
stuff. She's an activist, Canadian activist.
Real.
She'd be on Canadian TV in that. And she was quite interesting, actually. Lively and...
As I was listening to her, I was thinking you'd love the message that she's talking about. And meanwhile, you'd already spoken to her 2 nights before. Yeah. That is hilarious. But she went to work with a hospital in Canada. And in her presentation, she was showing photographs of the hospital meal when she got there. And it was just shocking. Like, it was a tuna sandwich and a sweet drink and like a lump of chocolate. That was your lunch. No alternatives, no thought to nutrition. And it was all about keeping the cost down. How long does it take to assemble? All of the staff were very heavily unionized. They had like rigorous kind of coffee breaks and, you know, work schedules and all of that kind of stuff. So when she wanted to change the sandwich, for example, to a different type of bread, there had to be a time implication study done. Who's going to butter the bread and that kind of stuff. So I spoke to her and how in the space of a year, she completely transformed it into cooking from scratch for no extra cost, no extra manpower required. And then the meal at the end, the photograph at the end that the patient in the hospital was getting was a nutritious, balanced meal that would actually, you think if you're eating it, that's going to help you get better, as opposed to this plastic looking piece of rubbish at the start that if you were in hospital for any longer than a couple of days, your health is actually going to suffer, you know?
Well, I don't think it's any different here, actually.
No,
fairness.
It's not.
Many times in a hospital over the years. And hospital food is just horrendous. Mm. Nutritional, everything. But I hope it's all fine and dandy. Someone like her speaking to, you know, the converted, I suppose. Mm. But was the minister like for health there to listen and learn? Because I did see her, she's offered to him, actually, that she would come and help. I saw that on Twitter or something during the week. But it makes no sense to be spending a fortune, which we still spend a fortune on the food you get in a hospital. That's just awful stuff. Mm. I see people bringing in their own food and all sorts of carry on, which makes no sense either.
But I suppose if the stuff that you're getting in there is just so bad.
Yeah.
I was unfortunately many years ago now, but I was in an accident in Galway and I was in University Hospital Galway and I was there for a couple of weeks, and after a few days the women that were kind of bringing around the meals, your lunch and dinner, even they felt bad about the stuff that they were handing me. And one lovely woman actually used to go then to the staff canteen and grab me a plate from there for one of the meals during the day. She even, like working there, knew that the meal I was getting just wasn't going to be good enough, you know. But the stuff from the staff canteen was quite nice, actually, I have to say. Much nicer than the stuff that the poor old patients were getting. But another topic that was covered over there, apart from Joshna Maharaj, who we'll talk about again when I bring in her interview, was food education. And food education specifically for kids. And there was a lady there from Peru, Carissa Becerra, and she has a foundation or an organization called La Revolucion, so C-I-O-N, in Peru. And it was only founded in 2015, so it's only 3 years old, this. But she's already spoken all over the world about this education program, and it's aimed at children in primary school, so primary school age. And it has four kind of pillars behind it, very, very well thought out, beautiful graphics around the whole thing. The message and delivery systems are very, very well prepared. They kind of come with packages that schools can take on board. There are activists that join this organization and then volunteer their time in certain schools. And over the 3 years, it seems to have really, really grown a life of its own, and very, very quickly. But the four pillars are start at age zero. And one of the things that they try to tell parents, or encourage parents to do, is to adopt a zero sugar approach below the age of two. So until your child is two, they should never have anything sweetened or any sugar in their diet at all.
I think that would be the recommendation here, the guidelines from the Department of Health here.
Yeah. But what she was saying is that it helps the child develop their palate. So if below the age of two, the child is taking in nothing but really, really sweet things from processed sugar, then there is no hope that they will ever adapt at later years to kind of bitter vegetables, for example. So zero sugar below the age of two, simple message. Then there was the Choco Revolution. So after two, so you have to give the kids some treats at some stage. And she's saying, give them chocolate. Don't give them jellies or processed sweets or Coca-Cola or any of that kind of stuff. Give them chocolate. But when you give them chocolate, don't give them much, and give them 70% plus chocolate.
Yeah.
So real chocolate made with cocoa. And that's their treat. And then because that kind of has a bitter flavor to it as well, it doesn't mean that the kids are developing a taste for purely sweet, sweet processed things. And then there's Como Como, which is another part of the program, which allows kids, kind of like the Food Dudes program in the primary schools here, where they get to taste and handle and look at vegetables and fruit. Because just like your woofer, not every kid is exposed to or gets to see or taste these kind of vegetables in their raw state. So, you know, I remember I was in my 20s when I had my first piece of broccoli, for example. You know, your woofer's in her 20s, is she?
18, but yeah.
But she never saw a beetroot in its raw
state. And the Food Dudes program, actually, because I had a chat with the kids before I came in, because I suppose they're at school to see what they were learning. And they both mentioned the Food Dudes program. And it's not that they're tasting anything that they haven't tasted before, but they're kind of encouraged maybe to taste new things with it. And they kind of like it, actually. So it's run by Board Bia, sponsored by the Department of Ag. But they get kids to taste things, you know, repeatedly. So you can't just taste things once and then think you don't like it. So they taste them like broccoli and peppers and carrots. Some kids mightn't have had raw carrots before, and some fruits. But then I was asking them, like, there's in SPHE, which is social personal health education at schools, there is a food and nutrition element in that. But I think it kind of depends on the teacher how much they
I
do.
I think so too.
But also, you know, you're getting, there's, I looked up this thing called, what is it called? Taste Buds, and it's like the safe food. Produce 8 sessions that a teacher can deliver to the class and stuff, all about how food is produced, where it's produced, production of processing and physical activity and all that kind of healthy eating stuff. But I think it's up to the teacher whether they really want to do that or not. So I suppose some kids might get lots of food education at school and some might not get as much. Same with music or whatever in schools too. So and there is Safe Food also have Little Bites, which is guidelines for preschool and creches and that. So there is some bits and pieces available, but I still think an awful lot of kids don't really. And it's probably too late, you know, if they're getting that at kind of 8 or 10, which is kind of when they get the Food Dudes. They should have been having that maybe much younger. But I know there's an awful lot of money has been spent on Food Dudes over the years with kind of, some people would say, not particularly well spent, but
well,
I still think it's better than actually nothing. So
absolutely, absolutely. It is better than nothing. And it is good that the kids are kind of forcibly, you know, made look at and try these fruits and veg in school if they're not getting them at home. I had a discussion with some chefs down there, though, and what she tries to do in Peru is she tries to get chefs involved at a local level so that it's actually a chef that comes in and shows them how to cook as part of the handling of the food side of things. And while we were having this conversation, the point did come up that we're maybe at a generational gap now in the teachers, where new teachers, or a lot of the teachers that are in primary schools now, wouldn't have had good eating or cooking habits themselves. And so it's simply they don't have the knowledge to pass on. So there may be a program to deliver, but if that's not something that you're particularly good at, or you don't particularly believe in it, and their days are just packed and the curriculum is just packed, you're right, it probably doesn't get the attention that it deserves in class. And I know that you can put in place guidelines and policies and all of that until they're coming out your ears, but if you don't actually implement them in the school, they're not worth the paper they're written on. And I went on and had a look earlier at the school's programme, and there is, as part of SPHE, this healthy eating and a look at the food pyramid and a talk about healthy lifestyles and a talk about healthy eating and nutrition and all of that kind of stuff. But I know from personal experience in my own kids' school, there were several kids, and my two would come home with horror stories of what kids were bringing in for their lunches. And some of these kids are suffering like real behavioural problems. And after an intervention in one particular case and a change in the lunch, even they at the age of 10 could see a difference in this particular child's behaviour in the afternoon. It only is common sense. Yeah. If somebody is drinking Coke and eating chocolate at 12:30 in the day, by 1 o'clock they will be bouncing off the walls, you know, at age 10. So the policies may be there, but if they're not implemented, it's not really going to work.
Well, one of mine, I think it was last year, the teacher last year gave them extra points if they had two pieces of fruit or veg. So there was an absolute like determination every morning. You know, if there was an apple and maybe not anything else, a carrot would be added in or something. There was always, or slices of cucumber, or whatever. And he gathered up like gazillions of points through the year. But that's, you know, that's effort on a teacher's part. Yes. She's checking things and giving them points, and that, in fairness to her, and fair play to her for doing that.
Absolutely.
He actually enjoyed that, and I think it did encourage a lot of the kids in the class, because they love getting points.
They do. They love the competition type thing, you know, getting your name up on the board and what position you are in the board and all of that. We better take an ad break, and when we come back, we'll continue talking about that. Text us on 086 353 7782. You can email the show, kitchengarden@corkc.ie. And you're very welcome back to the Kitchen Garden on Community Radio Kilkenny City. I am Francis Nesbitt from Crowan Cottages in Kilkenny, and I'm joined as usual by Mags Morrissey from the Hedgehog Bakery in Thomastown. And you can get in touch with us on the show today. You can send us a text message to 086 353 7782, or at any stage during the week you can email kitchengarden@corkc.ie. Now, the final part of the final pillar of this food education program at primary school level in Peru that I was telling you about, the Carissa Becara program that she set up, La Revolucion, was something called Saber Comer. Now, the names of all of these will mean nothing to us, but they're a play on words in Spanish, apparently. So they're kind of catchy little titles. But this one is the science of food. So they get to do experiments in the class. And you know how kids love messing around with stuff and making slime and all of that. But they get to do experiments in the class, but using food. So the ingredients of a dish are part of the science experiment, and then the results of the science experiment are things that they can eat, you know. Yeah. So they're freezing things to make ice cream, and they're making froths from things, and they're boiling things and all of that kind of stuff. And again, there's external help that kind of comes in to the classes, some volunteers, and they help the teacher with these programs, and the kids absolutely love it, she said. And in a few of the little clips that she played as part of her presentation, the thing that the kids seemed most excited about was not the cooking, right? It was this science, like
exploding tomatoes and microwaves and things, no?
Well, maybe not quite that dramatic, but, you know, adding certain ingredients to others and then they change colour or they froth up, or, you know, and then understanding why that happens. And they absolutely loved it. And I would love to see some kind of hands-on programme like that.
And was that programme, like, kind of sponsored by the Department of Education, or how did it get into schools?
This woman started it. She had the idea and she saw what was going on in her local school and with her own children. Okay. And she volunteered her time in her local school and from that developed a kind of network of like-minded people. And then they put together a program that maybe could be rolled out across the nation. They established the group in 2015. They kind of formalized it more. They got some funding from the state. 3 years later, she's like not only at Food on the Edge in Galway, she's at symposia in Italy and France and the United States where she's talking about this program. Because there is an appetite there for it. I think people have realized that there is something going wrong when we're producing, so like obesity is such a problem and type 2 diabetes and so on. So I think there is a willingness there at a government level to get involved and to do something. And as you said, they're already trying to do stuff here. But she just happened to be in touch with the Zeitgeist and created a network that could actually provide part of the solution.
Okay.
So she's not just going in and badgering politicians and saying, do something about it. She came to them with a program,
a solution. Yeah, very good.
And they got very heavily involved and now it's all over Peru. And it's funny when you hear somebody speak from a part of the world that we're not really that familiar with. Like there aren't that... I don't know any Peruvians. I don't know that much about Peru. But a lot of the same problems there as we have here, you know, 5,000-6,000 miles away.
Well, in Chile, they had like 3 out of 4 children were obese. So back in 2014, they introduced a tax on sugary drinks. They were one of the biggest consumer of sugary drinks in the world, actually, even higher than Mexico, which is apparently drinks an awful lot of Coca-Cola.
Oh.
They introduced a tax from 13% up to 18%, and then on low sugar drinks, they brought the tax from 13% down to 10%. And the study showed, and you know, the percentages aren't huge if you think about how much that would be on a bottle of cola or whatever. Mm-hmm. But there was a study done then, I think, in 2016-17, and it showed that the purchases fell by almost 22% of the very sugary drinks.
Isn't that funny?
Yeah. But I know they've changed. They have brought in higher sugar drinks have been taxed here as well. But they also brought in kind of a thing where, like you'd have on cigarettes here, health warnings. So they have health warnings on food with high sugars, high salts, high fats. That's a good idea, I think. And this, you know, that I'd love to see that here, actually.
So would I. You do get to the stage where they're, let's face it, an awful lot of these things are bought by parents for children. And a lot of parents are cost sensitive. So if there is an increase in price, then they may not go for the sugary one. They'll go for the less sugary one, regardless of whether the kid prefers the high sugar one or not. And then there is sometimes you hear the excuse of, I didn't know, or nobody told me about the kind of impact or sugar levels or... And food manufacturers and drinks manufacturers do often try to fool parents.
Always. I think, really.
You know, go for the healthier choice. Zero fat. We've spoken about it here before. Low in...
Zero fat, high sugar.
Yeah, exactly. So even when parents think they're doing the right thing, they can be misled. Whereas if you impose, just like happened with the smoking and the pictures on the packet and so on, if you impose mandatory messaging on the package, that removes that excuse of ignorance. So I didn't know. Nobody told me.
But I think bringing in changes like that also highlights the problem. So suddenly it's been discussed more, so people may become more aware of it. Mm-hmm. So they may change their habits based a little bit, you know, okay, not significant numbers maybe, but some may change their habits based on that. You know, you've created an awareness of the issues. So maybe... but I have to say I was amused at my two small boys who went dressed as like... fast food and like sugary drinks as Halloween costumes.
Oh, really?
I think of all the time and effort and all the talking that I do about healthy food and everything, one went out as a packet of chips from McDonald's, very carefully crafted in fairness, and the other was like a carton of Ribena or something. So, yeah,
but
scary looking things.
But there you go, that might be part of their message. You know, your McDonald's fries are scary. It's Halloween, it's scary. Maybe your education is rubbing off on them, you know?
Maybe.
But speaking of Halloween, there's lots and lots on, of course, and it's a time of the year that it's becoming a bigger holiday every year, I think, and pumpkins being a huge and significant part of it. Have you got your pumpkins in yet for carving?
No, not yet. No.
I see they're in all of the shops and stuff. And in Thomastown, the Thomastown Community Network are rerunning their pumpkins.
Pumpkins in the Park.
Pumpkins in the Park event on the 1st of November.
Okay.
And what happens there is that they ask people to bring along the pumpkins that they've decorated for Halloween night, and then they're all gathered in one place on the quay in Thomastown in that very large car park down there that the Tidy Towns have put a new little seating area into in a park. And then all of the pumpkins get one more last hurrah and shown off to everybody else, and then they're taken away and composted by the council. Which I didn't think was going to happen, but now seems to be happening again this year, which is great. And there's free hot chocolate on the night, but you have to bring your own cup or a reusable cup because they don't want to be using single-use plastic. So it's just a very wholesome event,
it is,
really.
Yeah, yeah. It's a nice evening, a nice hour of an evening. Yeah.
Yeah, I went along to that last year and saw your lot there as well. And it's good. And the kids love to kind of compare their pumpkins with everybody else's as they're up on the steps.
I might take a few pumpkins for the pigs, actually, save them, composting them.
Oh, good idea, yeah. Good idea, because they do love them.
They love pumpkins, yeah.
How are your pigs?
Good, yeah.
Are they almost ready?
I went to huge trouble to change the electric fence because one of them has been escaping, like, you know, I can kind of keep it in for a week and then it gets back to, it'll find somewhere else. So I went to huge effort today, changed the electric fence and stuff, and I went down 20 minutes later and both of them were out.
They came out to thank you for the effort.
I'm just putting my hands up and giving up with them. But they've absolutely destroyed the field on the pony, the horse.
Oh, no.
But anyway.
When are they off?
You know, they're the happiest pigs, actually, I think, this year. I actually took a video of them lying in the sun and having, like, a little piggy time earlier. It was quite funny. But as I was actually trying to fix the electric fence. Anyway, which they just didn't appreciate. There you go.
When are they off on that final journey?
Monday week.
Oh. Well, mine went on their final journey yesterday. And the one that had been doing the wandering as well earlier in the year was really, really big size. And the other one was much, much smaller. The difference between the two was remarkable. But I have them back now in time for the butchery course that's on at Crowan Cottages this weekend. So Saturday and Sunday, we've 12 or 14 students coming along each day to learn from Deck, who we've had on the show before at Nude Nutrition, and John Griffin, who will be bringing along a couple of deer as well. And so those 12 or 14 people will start in the morning learning some knife skills and about how to look after their knives and the safe use of knives. Then they'll bone out a chicken or cut a chicken up into its pieces to learn some of their, or to practice some of their knife skills. And then we get butchering the pig, so we'll cut that up into its primary cuts, and then we'll have some lunch, a very meaty kind of affair, and then in the afternoon we'll be skinning a deer and breaking that down and then making some sausages and burgers, and that's each of the day. So it's a fairly packed day. But people love it, and it's the weather will be perfect. It'll be nice and cool.
It's nice and cold, yeah.
Yeah, because you have to, obviously, while you're handling meat, you have to do it at low temperatures. And then it'll be over to the big house for some warming lunch and coffees and things like that.
Very good.
Yep, so that's 2 days of that. It'll be absolutely exhausting, but I'm looking forward to getting stuck into that. And people always seem to enjoy it. But that's where one of the pigs is going to go. And I'll have to tell them that the pork that they're looking at on the table with all of the fat that my pigs will have put on, not very similar to the pork that they'll find in the supermarket, unfortunately. Very different colour of the meat and all of that kind of stuff as well.
Yeah, a lot less fat on the supermarket stuff,
And it does, it kind of shocks people when they see it for the first time, you know, because they think there's just, wow, that's such a scary amount of fat. But when they're living outside, the pigs kind of need it to keep themselves comfortable.
They do, yeah. So I suppose.
And I would have been feeding them over the last few weeks now non-stop kind of apples and pears and stuff from the orchard. So I'm expecting great things from the...
My pigs have given up eating the apples.
They're sick of them, are they?
Too many. I've been getting them from the neighbours, like wheelbarrow loads of them. Yeah, today they were literally just walking over them. They had no interest. If you give them a piece of bread or something, they go mad for it. But I think as the weather changes, I see all the animals today wanted kind of more food. They were all hungry. So
I suppose they're generating heat.
And they are pigs anyway. I was thinking, great, loads of apples this year. But no, they've had enough.
Well, I suppose that, you know, that everybody kind of gets sick of too much of a good thing, or I suppose.
Maybe.
Mm. But it's, you were right, they were a very happy set of Sandy and Blacks this year from Dermot in Wicklow. And lovely looking pigs as well. The Sandy and Black is by far my favourite breed, I think. Fantastic breed.
Yeah, I like with these ones actually. Mm. And last year's ones were nice too, actually. Yeah, but mine seem to have put on a lot of weight in the past, or grown an awful lot in the past month. Seem to be slow for a while, but they're good size now, actually.
Good.
So yeah, be plenty of pork for a year at least.
Excellent. And you're getting sausages made by Betty down in
yeah,
in
I'm going to
well.
Actually change the order a lot this year, actually. Just you kind of get to know what you need and yes. what you use and stuff, and what's left still in the freezer. So I still have last year's one of the pig's heads with all my ideas and notions of making brawn. I haven't done it yet. It's unlikely it's going to happen this weekend anyway. Mm. So anyway, maybe next week we'll see.
Well, I have two heads as well hanging in the cold room for the course over the weekend. So it'll be interesting now when we pop those up on the block, what people make of them.
Yeah, but I assume people coming to a butchery course are not going to faint at a pig's head. I hope not.
Well,
unless they think they're...
It's funny. At a previous course, there was somebody who had absolutely no problem handling the meat, but looking at the head, they weren't into it. They just left the room.
Oh.
And they had no problem handling the deer carcass when the head was removed and it was on the block. Cutting the meat wasn't the issue, but looking at it as an animal, they weren't able for it.
Oh.
So, yeah, different people have different sensibilities.
Yeah, yeah.
Now, you've brought in some food today.
Yes, well, pickle. This is one of my favourite things, actually, I have to say, is beetroot pickle. So we have at least a winter supply of beetroot anyway, so there's plenty of, like, beetroot's a good source of lots of nutrients, actually.
Mm.
You can take a little bit there if you like.
Oh, I want to be careful not to
jars
bang
of
this
it,
jar
actually.
Down.
And... So the beetroots were picked, just took the leaves off and washed them and then boiled them. And depending on the size of the beetroot, it can take up to 2 hours. But according to the recipe now, I would think an hour is plenty. I think it's better if it's left with a little crunch. It doesn't need to be too soft.
Al dente, as they'd say.
Yeah,
yep.
Yeah.
That is really good.
Although I'm learning about German cookery actually a little bit with my woofer. They tend to, like you said, they would cook cabbage for hours on end. I made a risotto one evening and I had it was kind of like a wintry risotto with cabbage in it, and she couldn't get over the crunchiness of the cabbage, so they would have put it, like, cooked it for, like, I don't know, what did she say, 4 hours or something, where, like, I just couldn't eat it.
Maybe
at
my
stage.
Mother learned to make cabbage in Germany then, because that sounds like how Mammy Nesbitt used to make it.
But then for the pickle, you need sugar, water, onion and white wine vinegar. And all you're going to do is put your sugar in water, let the sugar dissolve in the water, add in your vinegar, and then pour those over the onions just for a couple of minutes and stuff, just to soften the onions. I quite like the onions. And then pour it over your sliced beetroot. You've cooked the beetroot separately and sliced it, and then pour it over and jar it. It's great. It's just
and
brilliant.
You have it very thickly sliced there as well, which is really nice. But just reaching in and grabbing a small piece, the tips of my fingers now are all red. It's unbelievable stuff for dyeing, isn't it?
If you splash
it anywhere.
It's actually, you can do all sorts of things with beetroot. You can make sourdough, or you can add it to sourdough. So you get a kind of a nice pink tinge through your sourdough.
Oh, yeah.
So I just saw some of the fellow bread makers were doing it during the week. You dry it a little bit, so like kind of shavings of it, and dry it, and then you can add it into your sourdough. It looks quite interesting, actually.
And
I
so
haven't tried it.
You'd have a kind of like sweep of colour, or the whole bread would be red?
Depending which way you want it, but you could just have kind of sweeps of colour through it.
Actually, one of the things I meant to tell you about Food on the Edge was Real Bread Ireland were there again. They had a stand, and every time I walked past, there was a crowd in front of the Real Bread stand.
Yeah, they were quite pleased. I was talking to the guys and stuff. They were quite pleased with how it went, because it's huge effort. Like, you're giving up of your time. You know, you get a ticket. I was offered a ticket to go and stuff, but I couldn't go. But just 2 days, and you bring all your breads and everything. So it is. It's a big commitment from the guys, and they did. Yeah, they did a great job, actually, in fairness to them. So they kind of went quiet for a day or two because they did a lot of talking after.
Yeah, I'm sure.
So Yeah, they were quite happy.
Like they were handing out bits of bread and, you know, with little bits of butter on them. And there was a lot of free food there. You know, there was samples all over the place, everything from oysters to cheeses and all sorts of stuff. And I'm telling you, the biggest crowds every day were in front of Real Bread Ireland.
Yeah, some of the good bakers were there at it, in fairness. So, yeah, they were.
And I took a great photograph, I put it up on Twitter actually, for them, of a group of young chefs in front of them. So that's really what you want to be talking to. You want to be talking to those guys.
Well, the whole thing, they just want, you know, it's kind of changing people's attitudes person by person is how they say. So, and that's what they did. So
well, they were doing a great job there, and fair play to them is absolutely right. Well, your pickled beetroot is really lovely. And that's
I have
you.
To say, my hands didn't get dirty in the making of that.
Okay,
Michelle did that.
Your woofer Michelle's pickled beetroot is absolutely lovely. Well done, Michelle, and that'll keep you going now over the winter.
Yeah, we have a good few jars of it at home, so yeah, it will do.
And on the pickle shelf, then this year you have your pickled beetroot and your fermented courgettes
and pickled cucumber.
Yeah,
my SCOBY is still alive, so I have a lot of jars bubbling away. So I've learned how to look after it, I think.
Have you tried any of your kombucha yet? Or
No. I don't particularly like it, actually. So I'm not sure what I'm doing it for, but it's just, you know, when you get given these things, you feel you should look after them.
I'm getting my kefir grains tonight. One of the butchers is bringing along some kefir grains, so I'll be making some kefir for myself.
Oh, he promised me kefir grains ages ago.
Well, listen, I'll get mine going and then I'll give you some of the kefir grains.
I'd swap him starter for kefir, actually, but that's a long time ago.
All right, okay. Yeah. Well, I'll if he brings enough, I'll give you some of them. Otherwise, you can have some of mine once it gets going. Now, we're going to take another break, and then coming up after the break, we'll be talking to Dermot Carey about getting onions and garlic into the ground for growing over the winter and maybe some other jobs to do in the garden this week. Text us on 086 353 7782. You can email the show, kitchengarden@corkc.ie. And you're very welcome back to The Kitchen Garden on Community Radio Kilkenny City. I'm Francis Nesbitt from Crowan Cottages, and I'm joined as usual by Mags Morrissey from Hedgehog Bakery in Thomastown. And you can get in touch with us. The easiest way now is probably by text 086 353 7782. Or at any stage during the week, you can email kitchengarden@corkc.ie. And we're live today, Friday, and the show is repeated on Mondays from 4 to 5. So don't bother sending in a text on Mondays. Now, we were just talking about Mags's beetroot pickle. And of course, pickle is a fantastic way of preserving any glut that you might have from the garden. And one of the themes at Food on the Edge this year was how to reduce waste. And there was several chefs looking at it from a profitability point of view. There was some business people talking about how if you have the wrong chef in the kitchen, it'll put your restaurant out of business because they'll be buying very, very expensive products, and then you will have to charge a fortune at the of your visitors to the restaurant in order to make it back. There was one brilliant story I heard of a restaurant not a million miles away, actually, where a new chef was hired into the kitchen, and suddenly the boss realized she was making absolutely no money. And one of the things that he was doing was he was buying organic local tomatoes by the kilo, and then he was making a tomato soup out of them, which is all very noble, but it was costing an absolute fortune. But there was a guy from the UK who founded a restaurant a couple of years ago called Silo, and they were taking waste reduction really to the next level, and they considered the food in front of every person and every piece of that, and even what it was served on, the plates and so on, had to be zero waste. So there was zero waste in this particular restaurant. The tables were made from intercepted, is what they called it, not recycled materials, but intercepted materials. So things that were on their way to the skip or to the dump. But a very, very stylish looking restaurant. Very, very stylish, very, very cool. And the plates were made from plastic bags that had been recycled. Their ceramics that they're using on glasses and so on were made from ground down bottles, which were then reconstituted into glass and turned into glass. Oh. All of the knives and forks and so on were kind of odds and ends that were, again, on their way to the rubbish dump.
Where is this place? Sorry?
Silo. It's in Brighton. And they have a restaurant, silobrighton.com, where they tell their story there. But everything from upcycling for the furniture to, you know, buying directly from farmers. Nothing comes in packaging. They reuse the crates. These guys have really, really thought about it. So it's unique. You'd got hard pressed to come across anybody else, I'd say, anywhere in the world that's doing it as much as they are. But it was, you could see a lot of people taking notes during their talk, particularly when they started to talk about how they reduce waste in the kitchen, and every part of every plant that comes in is used and so on. And then at the end, they have a composter for any of the food waste, like from people's plate, that obviously you can't go anywhere else. It goes into a kind of digester and produces compost, and then that compost goes back to nourish the fields.
Very good.
Really, really noble. Like the photograph outside of where the bins normally go, yeah, there were no bins. It was remarkable kind of stuff, you know. So that's Silo in Brighton. I'd love to go check that place out at some stage, but silobrighton.com, you can have a look at it there. Now, speaking of compost, we're joined in the studio by... Dermot, just pull up that microphone there close to your mouth there. Okay. We're joined in the studio by Dermot Carey, who's been on the show before to talk to us about his gardening work and all things gardening. And Dermot, you're the head gardener at Burton House. Yeah, and you also do some work with Avoca and so on.
Kitchen garden of Avoca Group.
Yeah, and you come from a market gardening kind of background. You know your spuds, as they say.
As they say, yeah. you know your onions.
Yes, and it's onions that you're here to talk to us
actually,
about.
Actually, I am here to talk about onions, yeah. It's a perfect time of year for planting overwintering onions or garlic, provided that your soil is well drained. It's an ideal time. As I say, with garlic, you plant them on the shortest day of the year and you harvest them on the longest. So we've plenty of time now, getting into November, right up until Christmas, for planting the garlic. I'd recommend buying in certified garlic. Like, you can get the garlic bulbs from the supermarket and break them up into individual cloves, and you might get between 8 and 12 seeds per bulb and plant them. But you're better off going for certified seed. They will be a bit more expensive, the certified seed. But the idea is you keep a few back yourself, you save the seed then the following season for a couple of seasons, and then you start again, you buy another batch of certified seed.
Because I have seen people on Twitter now boasting about it. I went into the supermarket and I bought this little bulb of white garlic that came from China, and I stuck it in the ground and it cost me little or nothing, and all of these plants are growing. The fear I would have with that is that you don't know where in China it was grown, and you don't know what little pesties were in the soil in China and what you're now introducing into the garden.
And as well as that, you know, the climate, the seasons are obviously completely different than China, so you're better off, if you are going to go down that route, is to get you'd be better off going for Spanish garlic. I'd have very, very good success with Spanish garlic. There's a variety called Velado, and in the supermarkets it usually has the origin, country of origin, and also very often the variety. So that's a good variety to go with, or you can also go with French garlic. But you're better off contacting the likes of Quick Crop online. That's www.quickcrop, and they will sell you the certified garlic bulbs. And there's another company called Fruit Hill Farm.
Oh, Fruit Hill Farm are great, yeah.
They're very good. They're online as well. Both companies will send the garlic out by post. As I say, they might work out a little bit expensive the first year, but the idea is to save your don't eat all your garlic. To keep a few back for replanting. And that's how you do it. And then maybe do that for 3 seasons, 4 seasons, depending on how successful you are. And then buy another batch of certified seed. The mistake people make is they keep buying the bulb every year.
Yeah.
And which you can do that too, but it works out. It's much nicer to save your own also.
It is, but I heard Madeline McKeever from Brown Envelope Seeds, who's been on the show before, I heard her speaking recently. She was actually at Food on the Edge as well. And she was talking about how her daughter had grown some sweet corn. And over the space of, oh God, was it 7 years or 11 years or something like that, she found that by saving the seed from the plants that did best at her farm down in West Cork, that over that period of time, they had completely changed the kind of sweet corn that they were growing. So when you think about it, it's selective breeding. So you're choosing the variety that loves your soil and loves your climate and so on. And by saving the best of them every year, you're kind of magnifying that.
Magnifying it, exactly. And also, if you are growing your own garlic, you can have them, you can eat the garlic green, as in you can have it in May. It looks almost like a leek.
Yeah.
So the chefs love the green garlic. They actually call it wet garlic, and very successful. And it's ideal for that time of year, because if you wait till August, July, August, you've so much veg coming out of the garden anyway.
Yeah.
The garlic's almost sidelined. Whereas if you eat your garlic wet in, or green actually, in May, there's not a whole lot of selection in the kitchen garden at that time of year. So it makes so much sense to eat it actually before it's time. And
so getting it in the ground now, what needs to be done to prepare the ground before you plant?
You want well-drained soil. If you haven't got very well-drained soil, obviously you don't want to sitting in a pool of water over the winter. What you can do is you can plant it on high beds, ridges, or drills. You can form drills and plant them on top if it's not particularly well-drained. I would tend to...
That way then the water, of course, runs off.
Because it's going to be sitting there all winter and it's grown very slowly. And you want it by spring, you want it 3 or 4 inches high. You know, you don't want it too tall going into winter or coming into early spring. The advantage of doing the overwintering garlic, you see, in our summers are not long enough or hot enough to plant it in the spring. So it's a bit like the winter corn, you know, sow it in the autumn, plant it in the autumn.
It gets a bit of a head start.
And it gets a head start coming into the spring then. And you get a larger bulb.
Ah, right.
You get a much larger bulb come midsummer, 21st of June, midsummer into July. So, and the other advantage then is you don't have the same problem with weeds. And that goes for the overwintering onions, because if you do the overwintering onions, you have them a month earlier than the spring planted onions. And then if you plant them into a tunnel, you have a 4 to 3 weeks earlier. So you're very early at that stage. You could be picking overwintering onions out of a tunnel. You could be picking them in April, maybe March, April.
Now, the thing I love about, well, I love lots about garlic and onions, but for a new grower of veg, some of them can be difficult to know when they're ripe or know when there is the best time to harvest. Sweet corn is a perfect example. Like, lots of people don't know when the cobs are ready. But onions and garlic will tell you when they're ready, because they'll get all yellow and floppy and they'll just
the onions particularly, they just fall over. The old way was to use the back of a brush and to actually force them over.
Yeah.
But now people are saying, no, just leave them alone, let them flop over. And then they just swivel up. They just turn yellow.
They look very sorry for themselves, actually.
But in the green barn at Burton House, what we do is we actually use them green. Like we love the onions for the green tops. As I say, we use a lot of onions, so we actually buy in the dried onions. So we particularly like the overwintering onions because we use them green.
Ah, very good. Okay.
And we can start even picking them as large scallions or spring onions.
Yes.
We could be picking them in, say, April, towards the end of March into April.
So for salads and the likes of that?
Yeah, they're perfect. By the time they become a dried onion, they're used up. Mm. And they don't store quite as well as the spring-planted onion.
And do you allow any of them go to seed, so to form flower heads, like scapes?
No, well, if you want scapes, the variety I gave you was Velado. That's actually a soft-neck variety. Mm. Now, if you want the scapes, you want the hard-neck variety. Mm. And they form the scapes. It's almost like a pig's tail. It's a kind of spiral.
That's the flower head which grows.
That's actually the flower head.
Yeah.
So if you want the scapes, you need the hard neck garlic. But I find with the hard neck garlic, the bulb isn't quite as large.
That's right.
You don't get quite the same. But I wouldn't go for the spring planted garlic. Definitely the overwintering one. You just get a far better. You just get a far bigger clove.
Mm.
And as I say, it makes so much sense, because out of one clove, one planted clove, you get between 8 and 10. So that's
a good return.
That's a pretty good ratio, isn't it?
Yeah.
So, and obviously the chefs, and they're using onions and garlic, they're used in the kitchen, so it's a no-brainer. And it's particularly nice this time of year, if you have a nice sunny day, to be out sowing or planting something, because coming into the autumn, it's like, oh, the weather is bad, and it's the gardening season is finished, and here I am tidying up, pulling out weeds. Yeah. But it's nice to be actually planting something into the ground.
I think you're right. That's brilliant.
Yeah, and it actually feels like spring. Like when I'm out a really sunny day, here I am levelling off beds with a rake, I'm planting my garlic. I particularly like planting garlic straight into the beds. It just it's just a really good feeling, you know.
And when you think about it, when you prepare a seed bed and you put in your seed normally, very shortly thereafter, and probably before the seed actually appears above the ground, the weeds are back. But at this time of the year, you don't really have that kind
of competition. Yeah, you don't have the weeds. You see, normally if we're doing spring-planted onions, we would plant them through a membrane. Like, you can buy a membrane from different companies, or you can just get black plastic or Mypex. You need to cut a hole or burn a hole through and plant your onion through it. That makes total sense. But with the overwintering onion, you're harvesting in May when the weeds are going to become a problem.
Yes.
At that stage, you're weeding and harvesting at the same time.
Yeah.
It just, it makes so much sense. And at that time of year in the kitchen garden, you don't have a huge selection. So if you do have your own onions and garlic, green onions and, as I say, wet garlic, or green garlic, it just makes so much.
So get them in any time between now and